lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very...
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street. Trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do, say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes.
Dr. Frank Farley with us. Frank Farley, PhD, is a professor and a psychologist at Temple University and a former president of the American Psychological Association. And Frank, I welcome to the show.
Delighted to be here, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, that there is one word that you've emphasized, which I really believe in and of itself was everything that caused us to be who we are to date, and it seems as though we're losing. And that word is innovation. That was the one thing that we stood apart from everyone else. We were so innovative. That innovation caused an idea. The idea manifested itself into something physical. There were sales, there were jobs, and we became who we became. And it seems, Frank, is we're starting to lose it now.
We might be, but we're not losing it a lot. I'm still an optimist. And
yeah, but
I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
The world is changing dramatically, and the communication is one of the big factors that's changing everything. Marshall McLuhan a generation ago said that because of communication trends, one day we will become the global village. We'll all be interconnected. Well, it's happening, and the source of it happening is American. That is, the whole digital world is just dominated by American thinking, American ideas, and American innovation. So, you know, just think Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, Brendan Page, the Google guys.
Sure.
Even CNN, which has been around for 30 years or so, the first global, you know, cable channel, space travel, the Nobel Prize in science and medicine. We dominate the Nobel Prize in those key fields.
Sure.
And so I'm an optimist. I really am. I think that I'm not too worried. I think we're going through a bad passage right now where we've hit some, you know, significant economic road bumps. But we are enormously resilient. And we're always coming up with new stuff and new ideas and new perspectives. And it may take us a while, but I think we're going to sort of create our way out of this.
No, by the way, Frank,
I have a strong feeling about it. You know, yeah. By the way, you could go back and I remember when they said Detroit, Michigan was dead on arrival in the 1980s. They just couldn't make cars that could compete. Well, we reinvented ourselves, we reinvented our manufacturing capabilities in Detroit, and now we're making terrific cars. So, you know, and that shows itself in so many different ways. So again, I'm an optimist.
By the way, I'm an optimist also. I think one of the biggest challenges we have to date happens to be the culture. The culture was not the same as the culture was 20, 25, 35 years ago. It's a different culture. It's a different mindset today. But one of the things I think backs up what you're saying, and by the way, I'm on your side of the table. I believe what you just said. It'll come back to us because we're cyclical. But I think one of the biggest challenges we had was the mindset. And if we watch what's going on throughout the country right now, with the anti-Wall Street, fat cat, da-da-da-da-da kind of stuff. Those people that are absolutely against the innovation and our ability to be creative and do are starting to, we're starting to see they have no idea what they're talking about. And if you interview any of them, they're not quite sure where they are. And I think they will eventually die out. And the people who are really in the know, those people who are diehard, staunch Americans who believe in what you just said, what I believe in, will start to come back to the fore. Every time that there's been a fence set up, something that we can't get beyond, somehow we've come through it. And the people that are blocking it really lose their strength in the way that they approach it.
Well, you know, you may be right, but I'm sympathetic with them to the extent that we have to watch that our country doesn't become, you know, an oligarchy of the rich. That is, you know, 1% of the people control 50% of the economy, and that's the way it is today. That's not good. In the long run, that is definitely not good. And if we go back to the founding fathers and so on, we were trying to create equal opportunity, a vital democracy, et cetera. And when we have CEOs of corporations that have done a lousy job and they get a $20 million bonus, I don't like it.
We're talking.
It doesn't set well, and I think, frankly, it's un-American. And, you know, sure, people should be rewarded according to what they have done in terms of creativity and productivity. But unfortunately, in the business world, in certain segments, not all by any means, and certain segments of Wall Street, they're not being rewarded appropriately for what they've actually accomplished. You know, I mean, take a look at my field, you know, science and universities and so on. You know, scientists create all sorts of fabulous things that save people's lives and so on. I mean, they don't get paid anything compared to, you know, a Wall Street trader, for example, or CEO at a major bank. And yet they are saving lives. They're giving us health care that's without parallel in the world and all of that sort of stuff. And so, and teachers are paid. Look, teachers here in Philly are paid somewhere around about, they start at around about $37,000 to $40,000 a year.
Yeah.
And our children are in the hands of these people. And most of them are terrific. They're trying their best thing. I teach teachers all the time. $40,000 to educate the next generation versus $20 million to do a lousy job as head of a bank. That's wrong.
I think it's all American. I don't think it's got anything
to do with my concern, which is the creative, innovative side. Those people doing the financial stuff and the bankers and so on, they're not being creative. They're not creating jobs and creating wealth for everybody. They're basically parasites, in a sense, who are, you know, and I turn to police. Police are starting around about 38,000, 40,000 in a dangerous town like Philadelphia, and that's not right. You know, they're there to protect us, and without them, we would really be in trouble, you know?
Wait, by the way, hold up.
What I'm saying is that we have problems of inequity that we do need to deal with, and I don't think it may reflect on creativity, but the people, the 1% who are controlling 50% of the economy, they're not particularly creative. If you think about Mark Zuckerberg, Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, these are very ordinary guys from very ordinary backgrounds. All three of them were college dropouts, for gosh sakes. Brendan Page, who founded Google, none of these people come from vast wealth. You know, they were just ordinary Americans, you know, who had creative ideas. I want to see more of that. I want to see less of that 1%.
Well, okay, but let's add something to this mix here, because when we talk about more of that, I want to see teachers paid more. I want to see cops paid more. You know, they go into dangerous situations. There's no question about that. But let's stop with government, with the hundreds of billions of dollars that are sent overseas. The money that they squander and they waste could be put back into our civilian population, can be put back into innovative jobs. All you got to do is tap into our oil reserves right here that haven't been tapped into. You got work for so many people. So a lot of this is not Wall Street. A lot of this is wasted government spending. Take a look at it.
Oh, no question about it. Boy, I agree with you totally. Why are we getting into all these wars at horrendous cost of lives and money? And, you know, we're one of the most generous nations in the world. We're giving money out to all sorts of countries, you know, to help them with this, that, or the other thing. And it's a wonderful motive, but, you know, charity begins at home.
And, I agree.
You know, we need a little bit more of that, in my view.
No, absolutely. By the way, absolutely, and there's no question about it. But they're not all Bernie Madoffs out there. And if you look at Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, what was it? They got bailed out for I don't know how many billions of dollars. Now they want another $5
billion.
And the executives are picking up $1 million apiece as far as bonuses. See, that's wrong. And that's not
that's,
Wall Street.
That's a government-related agency.
Yes.
Which means we own it.
Yes.
You know?
I got it.
And so our, you know, our Congress and our, you know, just aren't doing the job. I mean, every poll shows that this particular Congress is, you know, both the Senate and the House have a very low reputation.
Absolutely, no question about it. And I really believe what we need are with all due respect to attorneys, we don't need attorneys running the country right now because of the financial condition that we're in. We need business people running the country. Right now, it's cash in, cash out. And if we're not careful with all those trillions of dollars in debt we are, it's got to come from someplace, and it's going to come from the senior citizens. It's going to go against the kids that need the loans to go to school, and on and on and on. We know the list. So the problem really is the way that the country is being run right now. There's got to be somebody strong enough to get in there and stop all of the rules, the regulations, and the look at what we pay the IRS just to be the IRS, and you and I alone could not lift the IRS rules and regulations. I mean, we're talking ridiculous here.
We're talking ridiculous with a capital R. You know, when I pay more taxes per year as a university professor, who are not well paid compared to the business world, but when I pay more taxes per year than all of General Electric, and, you know, all of those things are part of the tax code.
Yeah, but the general
electorate is also. I think that what we need is fewer attorneys, and you know, I don't have anything intrinsically against attorneys, but we need fewer attorneys in Congress and more innovators, people who have a whole track record of innovation and creative thinking.
Absolutely.
You know, we've got a lot of our creative thinkers, and we have lots. Oh my gosh, I think we have the highest per capita number of creative thinkers in the world. But they're all over the place. They're in business, they're in universities, they're in education, they're here and there. They don't seem to be in Congress.
No, I got it. Frank, I hate to do this to you. We're starting to run out of time. Is there a website we can find you at? Is there a website we can get more information
from? Sorry, I should set one up. I haven't, but I can give you my email, and people can just email me any old time.
Wonderful. Thank you. Go ahead.
Frank.Farley at Comcast.net.
Wonderful. Hey, Frank Farley, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Michael. It was fun.
Take care. Good night.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Whit Hill with us, author of Not About Madonna, My Little Pre-Icon Roommate and Other Memoirs. Whit Hill was born and raised in New York City, where she trained as an actor and a dancer. Graduated from the University of Michigan with an FBA, a BFA, and for 14 years she was artistic director of a Michigan-based dance company. And a writer and a songwriter, she now lives and works in Nashville, Tennessee. Whit, hey, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. It's nice to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. That must be really good—a New York, Tennessee accent.
I've been working on it.
I can hear you loud and clear. What the book in and of itself, not about Madonna, My Little Pre-Icon Roommate, and Other Memoirs. What are we dealing with when we look at the world today through your eyes?
What are we dealing with when we look at the world through my eyes? Talking about the book or the world
in
general?
The book.
Well, it's as the title would suggest. It both is and is not about Madonna.
Yeah.
Just by saying her name in the title, one gets a hint that there might be something in there that deals with that subject, and it's true. Madonna was my roommate for 1 year when we were both dance majors at the University of Michigan back in the late 70s. And it was an interesting experience, and many people have asked me about it through the years and asked me about it and then asked me about it again.
Yeah.
And finally, a friend of mine said, you should write a book. And that had never occurred to me, despite the fact that I've always made my living, aside from dancing and teaching, I've made my living as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, gee, maybe I should think about that. And I started, and then I got bored and kept at it. And then years would go by, and I wouldn't work on it anymore. And one day I thought, wait a minute, why don't I make this the kind of book that I would feel really proud of? I'm a writer. That's what I do. Maybe I can make it something that has integrity and maybe a little bit of beauty. And that's what I set out to do.
Yeah. Now, obviously, we know it's not about Madonna, but she was the base. When I say looking at it through your eyes, we can see a Madonna in the 70s and what she stood for, what she symbolized. But you saw a different person, didn't you?
Well, yes and no. I mean, anybody who knew her at that time, we're always asked, were you surprised? And nobody says, yes, I was surprised. It was quite obvious that she was, just like she is now, a person with amazing intelligence and drive and a desire to be front and center. And those characteristics were certainly in place when I knew her. So, no, I wasn't surprised. The writing was on the wall that, but, you know, we were in college. We were thinking about ourselves.
Sure.
So it's not like I spent a lot of time thinking about Madonna and what she was going to make with her life. I was busy thinking about myself, to be perfectly honest.
Well, by the way, and most people do that without question, but when did you realize you were thinking about yourself before or after you wrote the book? Because when it really comes down to it, whether it's fact, fun, fiction, fantasy, you know, the when an author sits down to write about something, it's usually about themselves, but there's usually some place within the writing, when that cathartic aha moment happens, when you begin to see yourself in a completely different way. Did the book cause you to do that?
I don't know that the book caused me to think of myself in a different way. It got me to think of myself more as a writer than I had before. Before I'd been kind of a hack writer. I wrote everything, newspaper articles and a lot of events reviews and arts reviews and interviewing people and menus and anything that they would pay me for, I would write. And the act of writing this book made me think, wow, I could do something for myself that is meaningful to me and where at the end of the day I'm proud of it.
Yeah.
And that, so yes, it transformed me in that way, certainly.
No, I mean, because usually what happens is when you put it outside of yourself, you begin to see it. And then as you begin to see it, things start to happen in your life in and of itself. You look at your life in a different way. So I pick the book up and I read it page by page, cover to cover, not about Madonna. What do I, Michael Ray, get that I didn't have before? What's the core guts of that book that allows me to look deep into it? Male, female, it doesn't matter.
Well, it's funny because both men and women are responding really strongly to this book. I'm kind of surprised at that. I thought it was kind of a chick book, but it's not. I mean, men and women are saying, wow, this is so, well, for one thing, it's reminding people a lot of what it was like to be young in the 70s and to be in college at that time, that period of incredible self-exploration where the world just seems limitless. And, you know, it was kind of a beautiful time of great hope, and it was the late 70s. AIDS hadn't raised its head yet. We were just free and young and beautiful, and it was such a time of innocence, and I definitely wrote about that and what it was like to be a young person at that time and an artist at that time. Someone reading the book will learn about friendship, the way women forge friendships, even when they're really, really different people, as Madonna and I were. I don't think we would have been friends if we hadn't been roommates, because I was so introverted and she was so extroverted, and she was so intimidating and I was so quiet and meek, and she really loosened me up. So it's about those kinds of friendships and the way those friendships at that critical juncture in your life change you forever. It's about the way women function as artists in America, how they juggle being mothers and being artists at the same time. It's about the differences in the lifestyles between the incredibly famous, successful people and those artists, which is probably most of us, who slog around and try and make a living and stay true to themselves as artists, dancers, writers, musicians, actors, all of them. It's an interesting struggle, and it's something that I certainly know about firsthand and I wanted to write about. And I thought, having had Madonna as a roommate, what an interesting glass to look through when examining issues of the arts and success and celebrity and non-fame. What do all those things mean? And once I realized that I could use the Madonna angle as a way to look at these things,
sure,
the book wrote itself.
Now, by the way, there is a 7-page letter that Madonna wrote to you during Christmas break 77. The letter in and of itself. What was inside of that? And I don't mean word for word, but what was the guts of the letter? How did you look at it?
I came home from came back to our apartment after Christmas vacation it was 1977, and she had left this letter on my bed. It was 7 pages of closely written yellow legal pad. I mean, crammed. Every line was filled. It was like a journal. It was like her diary of what she did over Christmas vacation, because I have to say it, I think she was really lonely. And I had gone off with a boyfriend to Bermuda, which was the Bahamas, and it was at a terrible time, which is all written about in the book, but I think she had wanted to do something like that, and she just was kind of left alone in this apartment in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and saw her family for maybe one day, and she wrote it all down. And she was so affectionate and so sweet to me in this letter. It's beautifully written, and the penmanship is beautiful. That's why we wanted to include it, not only it transcribed, but so that people could see it. She really pours her heart into it, and she's so sweet and so innocent and so funny and so smart. And I think all of those qualities come out reading it. I mean, it's a beautiful letter, and I'm so glad I saved it. But, you know, I saved every letter that anybody ever sent me in college. So I like to go back and look at those things.
By the way, when we're dealing with it, and obviously it's not about Madonna, quote unquote, did Madonna read the book?
I don't know.
Oh,
I'd like to find out.
You didn't send her an autographed copy?
We have sent her, as best as we know how, we have sent her management a letter stating that the book is out, and we'd be happy to send her one if we knew where to send one. And, you know, my feeling is Madonna has a very busy, broad life,
sure,
with a lot going on. She's raising, you know, what, 4 children, and is all over the world and directing movies and so on. I would imagine this is not high on her radar, but who knows? Maybe she will read it one day. That wasn't my intention.
Now, by the way, arts today, do you find arts a little bit different than they were in the 70s, what you learned in school, the way you looked at the world?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's changing, and I'll talk about the music business for one thing. I mean, the music business transforms, it seems like, every week. You have to make a new adjustment in how you write and how you market yourself and what the possibilities are for making a living as a songwriter. And it's fascinating. It's a fascinating time to be working as a songwriter. And in some ways there are many more limits, and in some ways, in actually more ways, there are many more possibilities with the internet for getting the word out there about the things that you're doing. It's the same with dance. I mean, now dance companies they can put their clips online. I mean, back when I was running a dance company back in Ann Arbor in the 80s and 90s, we had to, you know, get these giant bulky video machines that looked like something out of the Pleistocene era, and get a studio and hire dancers and film these things and then send them to be edited and package them up and send them off to the arts endowments to be judged whether you were fit or not to receive a grant. And things have changed so much. Now a dance company can have a website, and bingo, everything's up there for the world to see. So yeah, it's been fascinating to watch the transformation of the way people make art and also the way consumers and audiences experience it.
Okay, I'm going to tell you something, but you got to promise not to tell anybody.
Okay.
Our secret: I was brought up with rock and roll. There's a little bit of the different music than they have today. I think 20 years before you went to college, I was a teenager rocking and rolling.
Well, that's a classic American sound. It never dies.
Oh, yeah, there was a world. Okay, we're just about out of time. Let me ask you this. Website we can find you at and buy the book.
Great. Well, again, the book is called Not About Madonna, My Little Pre-Icon Roommate and Other Memoirs. And it's out on Heliotrope Books out of New York City. And my website is withill.com. That's withill.com. And we have a Not About Madonna Facebook page, which is a lot of fun. We have some interesting discussions on there, so people can meet up with us just by searching Not About Madonna on Facebook and find us there as well.
Wonderful.
And the book is available on Amazon.com.
Dynamite. Hey, Whit, thank you so much for being with us. I've appreciated your time, and I hope everybody buys that book.
I hope so, too. Thanks, Michael.
Okay, good night.
Good night. Thanks again.
And the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a loving burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Every night I hope and pray A dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms. I know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
As I grow old, because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover, so I don't have to dream alone.
Dr. Irina Cole's with us. Worked as a physician in Russia and in Israel. She's got a master's degree in healthcare management. She's a certified professional coach, a founder of the personal achievement and consulting company Journey to Your Destiny, and the author of the upcoming book, Taste of Thoughts, How Changing Your Eating Habits, The Blueprint, How Changing Your Eating Habits Blueprint Can Improve Your Life. Irina, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good evening.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. By the way, there's so many people that go on a diet. Irina, they go on the diet and they think they're doing fine, and all of a sudden it's not working, they're back to square one. They go find another diet, and it's the same thing, and you've got all of this mass media saying, eat this way, do that way, lose calories that way, and most of it doesn't work. Where's the magic? Where's that something that we can find? Let's call it the blind spot. That's something that's hidden that could solve the problem. Where is it? What are we missing?
Yes, you're right. People go on from diet to diet, and it doesn't work so good. So the key is in helping people to uncover the roots of the weight gain and to develop new healthy habits and stop eating, counting calories, and start just eating smart. And I strongly believe that the extra weight, it is not just a nutrition issue, but a mindset. And that requires a complex approach. So it is not about just numbers. It's about what we think and how we feel about those numbers.
So effectively, it's how we think and how we feel about the food that we eat. And I guess there would be an emotional impact for everything that we eat. And I know many, many people eat to protect themselves. They're not getting filled up emotionally. So symbolically, what they do is they fill themselves up with food. And we've been taught to eat this, it tastes good. Eat that, it tastes good. And the next thing you know, we are driven to the store to buy what we shouldn't be eating. So what you're really saying, it's not how you eat, it's what you eat.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely right. And it comes, it basically we need to look far back to our eating habit blueprint, because it starts even from our embryo life. We receive it from our parents, and then in early, when we are little kids, we also learn from parents and family members, and then later at school. And we behave like this because we just used to this. This is what we've heard. This is what we've learned. So when we think about it and when we analyze our habits, our family traditions, and everything we've heard as a little kid, we can uncover those roots. And there are many of them. Everyone of us can uncover a lot of roots in our family traditions.
No, and by the way, one of the things I know you talk about, what is it that the French do differently than we do here in the United States? What do they do different that causes them to not have the obesity problem that we have here?
Right, right. I was personally inspired by the French nutritionist, Michel Montagnac, and I was just run into his book in the library, and It was literally changed my entire life. His book, Eat Yourself Slim, and I read it 3 times, and it took me about 3 months to change my eating blueprint. But since then, I'm so happy that I read that book and then changed it. And the main point there it is not counting calories, but eating right food. He explains low glycemic index nutrition and the how the point is not in amount of calories, but in origin of calories, where they are coming from. Because it's obvious that 500 calories from cheesecake, it is not the 500 calories from cucumber. And when we buy food, and we need just to look where it is coming from. And this, the first step in changing our attitude. When we start looking, yes?
Oh, I was going to say, so in essence, if I walk into the market, and I'm very careful with what I get. If I get more natural food, more raw food, things that are not loaded with, what did I see the other night? My sister came back with something. There was lard in it. You know, I took a look at this, and there was actually lard in the ingredients of what was being made. I knew what it was. It was a can of refried beans. That's what it was. Normally, when I get a refried beans, I'll get the natural vegetarian stuff. But she came in with the can, and I looked at the ingredients. There was actually lard inside of it, which is very interesting because I can eat a can of vegetarian refried beans and a can of this other stuff with the lard in it. One I can gain weight with, the other I wouldn't.
Yes, we need to look. Basically, there are three foods that we need to look that should not be there. There are three main bad things. We need to look for sugar, for starch, and all products contain starch, and for white flour. So when I see this in any products, it goes back to the shelf. Unfortunately, when we read the ingredients, there are so many ingredients there, and it is easy to be lost. But when you know what you're looking for and when you know what you don't need, it is much easier. Much easier because basically we have such a huge choice of food here. You have a lot of choice. So it is easy to choose. You just need to know what is good for you and what is not good for you.
Sure.
And this is easy to do.
But can you find anything without sugar? I understand starch, white flour, and actually sugar, starch, and white flour eliminates about 90% of the food that you can get in the market. But can you find anything without sugar? Most things come with natural sugar, even if they don't add any. And it's very hard to find something without the sugar. How do you do that?
You know, this is maybe, you know, like law of attraction works. When we're not aware about something, we think that it does not exist. But as soon as we know about this and we are looking for this, it is everywhere. We just see it everywhere. And when we start look for this, yes, it is very easy to find. There are a lot of, and I'm not talking about organic food or something like this, no. There are even, let's say, jam. It is a sweet product, and there are many manufacturers that produce 100% fruit jam. So it is sweetened by fruit sugar. And not by another kind of sugar, because there are many kinds of them. When it is sweetened by own juice, fruit juice, this is completely different, because this is already, it doesn't increase our sugar level dramatically. It doesn't increase insulin level. And that's why it doesn't put us in this bad habit cycle. So when we choose this gem over another one, we are all set.
Okay, so really what we're looking at is there is a natural sugar that's produced by the food, so what we should watch out for is the processed sugar.
Yes, but there is a misunderstanding also between organic sugar or brown sugar. These are all the same, so it doesn't matter. Sometimes people think that if it is organic sugar or brown sugar, it is better in terms of influences to our pancreas and elevating of our blood sugar, it is absolutely the same. So there is no difference. But we definitely can find products without sugar.
And I think most people they need to be held by the hand. There needs to be a step-by-step-by-step process to move them through. You said it before. If you don't know about it, there's nothing you can do about it. So it's
absolutely.
To begin with, it's the knowing, and I think one of the most important things that we've said here is how you're thinking influences your eating habits, because it's how you think that's going to cause you to do and be anything in your life.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely, because it improves. It is not just about losing extra weight. It's about feeling how you feel about yourself. And when you feel differently, you behave differently. Maybe you want to improve relationship, or maybe you want to improve your career situation and easier to approach to customers and make more sales, improve your money situation, financial situation. So it expands so widely. It is not just about the weight. It's about the whole life. And this is so important. So when we change how we think, we change our results. Because how we think, this is how we feel. When we feel like this, we act like this. And when we act like this, we receive absolutely different results.
Okay, but this also has to do with that biochemical thing that we call a body and a brain. Because how we feel about something is going to release certain chemicals. And I really believe, if we get a handle on that, then all of a sudden things start to change. Because when we think a thought, that thought, whatever that emotion is stimulated, there's a chemical that is driving that emotion. So if we understand that, and then we can get behind it and then put us in a direction that's going to do some good for us.
Right. You're absolutely right. Yes. So in changing thoughts, it is changing many, many things in our life.
Okay, 10-step plan for weight reduction. So, and we don't have to go through the whole thing because if they want it, they'll go get the book. but what's that first step in that plan?
Yes, first, we want to be aware about this, right? When we want to be healthy, lose weight, we want to be aware about this. Are we okay? Do we need to change something? Is something wrong? Then the next step is admitting. We need to admit. We need to understand that something is wrong. We don't need to ignore this, because this is important. And it is not about fitting the dress for friend's wedding. It is not about admitting that something is on. It is not about that I'm bad. No, it is not about this. But it is about something is going wrong, that it influences my life, that I need to be a little different, and just desire to change. So,
you know, a lot of it has to do, you were talking early on about relationships, about business and so on and so forth. The most important thing is we have a discipline. Most people are frightened to death of that word because they think that they've got to really apply themselves. But you're disciplined to eat the wrong thing. So why can't you rediscipline yourself to eat the right thing? You discipline yourself to act horrible in a work situation, and you can discipline yourself to do the reverse of that. So effectively, it is just habit, repetition of action until it becomes natural, and it's a discipline any way you look at it. It's a process. And life in and of itself, is a process.
Yes, it is. It is, and it's developing a new habit. Why we have any habit? We're just used to this. This is what we used to. This is what we think this is right, because this is how we, what we saw in our family. This is how we behave. This is just came from the very, very our first steps. But it may be not right. Maybe some habits are good, basically.
Sure.
Maybe our parents or grandparents developed in us very healthy habits. But we even maybe don't know about them. So it is also important to uncover those good habits and develop them and uncover unhealthy ones and minimize them.
I mean, there's so many people that are frightened to death of change. You know, you get into a quote-unquote habit, you get overweight, you gain the 50, 80 pounds that shouldn't be there, that's causing all of these physical problems and so on and so forth. And I've seen a lot of people today in today's world that weight is a protection mechanism for them. And you're right. A simple shift in thinking can make the entire world look completely different. But most people are frightened to death of doing something different. And that, I think, is the biggest challenge for most people out there as regards to losing weight.
Yes, but also the big impact here is from wrong beliefs. Again, like about colors, it is just an epidemic. Like, it is printed everywhere. It is calculated with any very, it's even ridiculous, like 237 or something like this. It is never 240. And this is what people use to, we just count and count and count. And sometimes it is pretty difficult for us to adjust something new. Especially when someone suddenly says that maybe we avoid any food for years, and suddenly you hear that basically this food is good. It is not easy. It's not, I admit, this is not easy. And that's why these 10 steps can help slowly, slowly go and succeed. Because it is not why I always say that setting the goal should come from a positive perspective and not from something negative. It shouldn't be, you know, standing in front of a window and say, oh, I'm fat and ugly. It doesn't work. We are back to this point many times. So it should be a positive goal, about be healthier, live a healthier life, enjoy life, because life is so beautiful, and we have such a huge choice of food, and we want to enjoy food, we want to enjoy family gathering and social events and romantic dinners and dating, and diet is not an option. It's not an option. We can't be on a diet 24/7. We want to eat, we love to eat, and it's fun. So the only option is a lifestyle. Just create the lifestyle which keeps us healthy. So we want to live longer, this beautiful life, right? This is an option.
We're just about running out of time. Website where we can find you and the book at?
Yes, my website is www.weightdestiny.com. My book will be published in a couple of months, and the information will be posted there immediately, www.weightdestiny.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Irina, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
You always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a wanna eat. Said some of these days I do it so good. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if for you need me, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're missing your brown-eyed daddy. Grab it now, some of these days.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Peter Walsh with us. He's a clutter expert, organizational consultant who characterizes himself as part contractor and part therapist. He hosts Enough Already with Peter Walsh on the Oprah Winfrey Network, and he holds a master's degree with a specialty in educational psychology. He is the author of Lighten Up, Love What You Have What You Need, Be Happier with Less. Let's say, Peter, I welcome to the show.
Michael, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when you really come down to it, just that tagline really says it all. Love what you have what you need, be happier with less. Everybody wants more. They're not happy with what they have. And you know what? They don't pay attention to it, and it dilutes itself.
Well, you know, I think we've said it all. It's been great chatting. I think you've nailed it in one. Look, it's so fascinating to me. I spend my life going into people's homes, helping them deal with just the sheer volume of stuff they have, the clutter in their homes, the stuff they've bought. And I think it's, you know, you've nailed it. We live in a culture that says that more is better, that if we just buy the right thing, if we just buy the right stuff, somehow we can acquire the life that we want. And, you know, in my experience, and I think in many people's experience, it's really a dead-end road, and I think we're seeing a lot of that around us at the moment.
Peter, do you think people hide themselves in the clutter? Because I've walked into houses where they're absolute messes, and you can't get near these people, I don't care what you do. When I say near them, I don't mean physically, but just they don't open up. And I have found...
You know, it's interesting that the stuff that I see in people's homes, I think can be broadly categorized into two areas. People hold on to what I call memory clutter. And that's very much the stuff that they're worried about, that if they let it go, they'll lose an important memory from the past. And then there's I might need it one day clutter. And that's the stuff people hold on to in anticipation of a whole lot of imagined futures. And I think the interesting thing about the stuff we buy is that it's very easy to get, or the stuff we have in our homes, it's very easy to get caught into this obsession with the past, being stuck in the past, or this fear of the future. And I think emotionally and spiritually and psychologically, it really does isolate people to the point that they have trouble really interacting with other people. And I think in the extreme cases with hoarders, you know, even physically, they build this stuff as a barrier between them and others.
And by the way, if you walk into somebody's home, and let's say you go out with somebody for the first time, and you walk into that home, and you see the clutter and the rest of it, or the non-clutter, you could pretty much tell what they're going to be like. And I think one of the things that you talk about with your life audit, which I think is extremely important, is the difference between a dream and a goal, and most people don't make that distinction.
Yeah, you know, it's very easy, I think, to get caught into this idea that, you know, if only I had, you know, that, oh, I can imagine myself with this. And the problem with dreaming is, you know, it's not necessarily a bad pastime, but the bottom line is that dreams are really the fantasies that don't have any reality, you know, any basis in reality. I'll win the lottery one day. Whereas goals are really about, you know, very, very set ideas, a set plan with a specific objective about where you would like to be. And in many of the homes that I go into, you know, people are caught in this kind of almost dream state of, you know, I just need more. If I have more, I'll be happier. If I buy this stuff for the kids, they'll be happier, instead of stepping back and saying, as a family, we need to set some really clear goals for our family, you know, not just in terms of our finance, but in terms of where we want to be. And I think without that, we're really like a ship at sea that's pretty rudderless.
The home audit, which I think is extremely important, just to move you there, it's the what can you do without? How about everything? And when I say it that way, the only constant in your life is what you see in the mirror that stays with you.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing in my book, you know, that I ask people to do three audits, you know, a home audit, a life audit, and a stuff audit. And for me, the question comes down to, does the stuff you own help you create the life you want? You know, and I, you know, to use something, I was checking out your website, for example, and I know that you do media training, and one of the things you ask people is to identify their core message. And it's an interesting, and I love that terminology that you use, Michael, that why do we not ask that question of ourselves? What is the core message of our lives? What is the core message we want our homes to say to other people? And the thing then is, after you answer that question, then look at the stuff you have and ask, does the stuff you own, do the things in your house reflect what you want your life to reflect, what the core message is of your family and of your life? And if they do, that's great. If they don't, what are they doing in your home? And that's part of this home audit I ask people to do.
By the way, it's coring down also with what you're doing. And I can't tell you how many people that if I walk up to somebody in the street and if I say, with a business, whatever it is, Peter, what is that core message? What is it that, what's that certain something you want people to know?
Yep.
Do you know how many people don't know? And I think,
well, I think it's true. I think that's absolutely true. And it's frightening enough if it's a business that you're looking to generate money from, or a business that you're looking to sustain your family from. But what about your life? Like, what is the core message of your life? What do you want your life to say? What do you want your home to say? You know, what do you want your kitchen to say? What do you want your bedroom to say? What is it reflecting of your life? And I think it's horrifying that so few people ask that question. And for me, in dealing with the stuff in people's homes, or the way they speak or interact, or the relationships, or even what they eat, you know, to ask that question first can really transform the way people live their lives.
Oh, absolutely. You know what I think it really boils down to? There was an old Harvard law school, there was a question that came from, I can't remember what the company was, which is so true. And it went like this. If you were going to, you're doing a project at home and you want a hole in the wall, and you go to the hardware store to get a drill, and that's going to make the hole. And the question is, what are you buying? You buying the drill or the hole? Most people say they're buying the drill. Well, they're not. They're buying what the drill can do for them, which happens to be the hole. And in all of the audits that you're talking about, it's getting down to the hole. What is it that what does this mean? What are you going to get out of it? What's the benefit? What's the value, that perceived value for everybody? Everybody's running around creating drills and buying drills, and that's not what it is that you truly want. And what I'm seeing here and hearing here is you're coring down to, quote-unquote, the whole, the real value of what it is. And most people need to be held by the hand and said, okay, here's the first step, here's the second step, here's the third step.
And I think you're right. And for me, the thing that surprises me constantly is that, you know, the work that I do is overwhelmingly about common sense, overwhelmingly about applying some simple common sense. And whether it's, you know, in the case of this book, Lighten Up, it's very much about, you know, our financial life and where we, how we define happiness, where we derive happiness from in our lives. But if we're not clear about the life we want to be living, if we're not clear about the role that our stuff has in our lives, if we're not clear about where we get our happiness from, it's no wonder that we end up running around in circles chasing more stuff, thinking that it will give us the happiness that stuff never can. And so I love the analogy of the drill and the hole. And I think, again, you know, it's a parallel kind of example that I think really does shed light on this discussion.
And it also brings it down to, quote unquote, when I say you in the general sense of the word, it's, Peter, it's called, what do you want? Most of us live our life based on what we think somebody else thinks is a good idea, quote unquote. So we're not truly living our life. And I would venture to guess, and I'm not in the business, but if I were to walk into a lot of homes and I would see how that home was decorated, the way it was kept and so on and so forth, I would venture to guess that most people aren't keeping their homes for them. It's what they want somebody to think about it when they walk in, and has nothing to do with them. And I think they missed the mark.
Well, I think you know, all of us are caught into that to a greater or lesser degree, but I completely agree that the automatic reaction to getting a raise or getting a promotion is, I should get a better car. You know, that the signs of success in our society are very much about the acquisition of more, shinier, bigger things, whether it's the car or the house or the jewels. And I think that in many ways, large and small, we're caught into this idea that the acquisition of stuff is the way that we show others, you know, how well off we are, how well we're doing. The problem is that a lot of that acquisition, as we know now, looking at, you know, look with a bit of hindsight over the last few years, a lot of the acquisition of that stuff has been based on nothing, you know, on credit cards or on, you know, inflated values that really, in the real world, make no sense. And when it comes down to it, when the bubble bursts, you know, we're all standing there in our underwear, no better off than the guy next door.
Oh, sure. And I think one of the major messages here, too, as I'm listening very, very closely tonight, it's okay to be you. It's okay to be what you want, not the guy next door. And if you don't want to drive a new BMW, drive what you want to drive. If the pickup's what you want, then do that. And guess what? At the end of the night, when you go home, you get to look in the mirror and smile and go to bed and have a good night's sleep.
Well, and that's the basis of the book, that the word less has such a negative connotation. But my thing is, how about having less stress, less worry, less things to pay for, less stuff to look after? That if you look at less in that sense, maybe, just maybe, having less of those things actually gives you more of the things that you can really value. And I think that you're saying the same thing, that living within your means, that living for yourself, that only having the things that reflect your core message or the life that you want, that's how you can live a life that's really enriching.
And by the way, living within your means does not mean that you have to watch everything you spend, that you have to cut the corners and so on and so forth. Living within your means means live the way you want to live, and you don't have to have the quote-unquote the BMW again or whatever the case may be. So living within your means is a good message. It's a comfortable message.
Well, living within your means, there's another term for that. It's called freedom. It's called financial freedom. And as far as I'm concerned, that's a pretty good thing.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people today would love to have that in and of itself. Okay, here we go. I pick up the book. By the way, I've got the book in my hand. I read the book page by page, cover to cover. Peter Walsh, what do I get? What do I, Michael Ray, get that I didn't have before when I finished this book?
From looking at and reading Lighten Up, you have an opportunity to redefine your relationship with your stuff. You have a clear path, a clear guidebook for opening the discussion with your partner and your family about what makes us happy, where do we derive happiness, and you have an opportunity as a family, as a couple, as a family, to look at your life, your money, and your stuff in a new way and answer the question, does the stuff we own, does the life we're living, does it reflect what we want? And if it does, I think happiness is much closer. And if not, it's no surprise that you just can't grasp that happiness that you're chasing.
But by the way, I think a tagline to the tagline in the book would have been great when it was a redefine your life, because that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about take the definition that you used to have, throw it out the window, redefine it the way that you want to define it, define it in a comfortable way. And if you went through each part of your house, it's nothing more than an expression of you. Everything we do in life is an expression of who we are, the way our attitudes, behaviors, emotions, etc., how they come out. And they'll show themselves in our surroundings. And I really think that's what it's all about. If you want to come into my home, you're going to know who I am if you know what you're looking for the minute you walk through that door.
And if you step into the front door of your house and you feel stressed or overwhelmed or out of control, if your house doesn't give you that sense of focus and motivation and peace and calm, then that's what I'm offering you. That's what this book and my work will do for you, It will help you create a space that really reflects the life you want and be a still point for the life that you should be living. And that, for me, is the fun in what I do. And it's great to watch that light bulb go off for people time and time again.
Wonderful. Peter, is there a website we can find you at and the books?
Sure, very easy. Peter Walsh Design is the website. Very simple. Follow me on Facebook. And I've actually just released an app for iPhones and iPads that really presents all this in a step-by-step way. So if you want to check that out at the Apple Store, be my guest.
Great. Hey, Peter, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Take care. Good night.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dan F. is with us. He's the author of Don't Drink and Go to Meetings. He was born in the Bronx and started drinking very early on in his life, but possessed most of the characteristics of an alcoholic before picking up that first drink. Let's see if this sounds familiar out there. He was an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. He was self-centered to the extreme and emotionally immature. He felt he didn't fit in and was always on the outside looking in. And all of that went away when he picked up the first drink, and he unsuccessfully chased that feeling for over 24 years. Hey, Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, there are so many people that hide themselves in alcohol and in drugs, and especially today, I think your message is critically, it's got a critical timing to it, because when I go back to when I was a kid 150 years ago, there we didn't have the availability of what there was today. The worst thing that would happen is we'd all buy a bottle of beer and we'd run around and act drunk and that was it for the night. But today it's a lot worse. How do you get someone who you know has all of these characteristics, you know the possibility, how do you sit them down and have them take a look at themselves?
That's really difficult to do because, you know, you may think someone's an alcoholic, but until they can admit it to themselves, it doesn't mean anything. You know, they have to get to that point, and that point I think is the same for every single alcoholic, with a perception of pain from the next drink outweighs the perception of pleasure.
Yeah.
And once they get there, there's hope for recovery. Until they get there, there's almost nothing that can be done to prevent them from picking up the next drink. Now every time I go out in public or I meet anyone, you know, I may be the only representation of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous they ever see. So it's a program of attraction rather than promotion. And so the idea is to live the kind of life to show. Yeah, so many people saw what I was like when I was drinking. And there were more people watching me, and I guarantee you, just the same is true for every other alcoholic. More people are watching them than they realize. And by the same token, when you stop drinking, the same amount of people, if not more, are watching you. And they see there's been a change. And more people have come up to me because of that change in me and asked me, you know, how did you do it? What happened? But, you know, I tell you, my son is a recovering alcoholic. I didn't even know he was one until he came to me and said, "Dad, could you take me to a meeting?" And you know, and here I am, the expert, yeah. and I didn't have a clue. You know, so it's individual. Every case is different. You don't have to go as far down the ladder as I went. And my hope in writing the book was that people could, you know, read it, identify with it, and say, "Hey, that sounds like it might be me, and maybe there's something I should do now before I went through what Dan went through."
Yeah, by the way, Dan, what I've seen over the years, and I haven't been through it, so I have to stand from the outside looking in on this, but the word addiction, you know, I've seen so many people mm-hmm. who were, quote-unquote, addicted to alcohol or drugs, but then when they've slowed it down, they've got into feels where they were addicted now to something else. I really believe an addict is always going to be an addict. It just depends on what you want to move all of that energy into.
Well, you know, there's a lot of different theories on that, and I'll tell you mine. You know, the drinking is the tip of the iceberg. Taking drugs is the tip of the iceberg. I drank because of my problems until drinking became my biggest problem. Now, I can't deal with the underlying problems till I put the drink down or the drug down or the shopping or the gambling or you name it, whatever your addiction is, and deal with what those underlying problems are. What made me drink? Why did I drink? Because of my problems. What were my problems? I'm self-centered to the extreme. Manifests itself in emotional immaturity. And all the things that go along with it, that huge sense of entitlement, the grandiosity. You know, and those same feelings are pretty much similar throughout all the different addictions. How we deal with those problems, you know, I have something chemically in me that when a drink goes down my throat, there's a click, and I feel everything's going to be okay. You know, now I feel better. Somebody else may experience that with sex or with the drug or with shopping. But the idea is to get rid of those feelings within us that make us feel uncomfortable within our own skin.
Now, from what I understand, and I'm not a clinician, so let me qualify that. But what I understand that, you know, dopamine, that chemical that comes out of the brain, that feel-good chemical, for most people who are addicted, it doesn't get produced. So the alcohol and the drugs take the place of the dopamine. It's the feel-good. There's so many people who hide, obviously, in alcohol and drugs. But at the same time, there's got to be a way for those chemicals that are missing, to replace them if somebody knows early on. And I don't know if that's even a possibility.
Well, I don't know either, Michael, but I know there are solutions. I know, you know, countless, there's 3 million sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yeah.
And there's millions more that have gotten sober in a variety of other ways. I mean, some have gotten sober through the church. Some have other gotten sober through counseling. Some have just gone white knuckle. But in order to stay, and I could stop, I could have stopped drinking every week. I stopped drinking. I couldn't stay stopped because I still had those underlying problems. And so, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous offers a 12-step program of recovery that helps you address those problems and change. I mean, one of the reasons I wrote the book is I've been sober a long time now, and I would go out telling my stories to various AA groups. And it got to the point where I was telling it in third person. And the reason I felt that way, because I was no longer that person that I was 28 years ago when I had my last drink. And that's kind of what prompted me to write it down. I'm not a writer. My training is in accounting. You know, that's the furthest thing from a writer you can get. But I wanted to get this story out there. Number one, and it's designed to help people in recovery or in need of recovery. When you talk about people in recovery, you're talking 3 million. When you're talking about people in need of recovery, you're talking tens and tens and tens of millions.
Yeah.
So there's a big audience. It's needed to, and for the most part, there's not much in the way of education out there right now about alcoholism or drug addiction, and even a lot of the people in the medical community aren't really up to speed. That alcoholism is a medical disease. The AMA classifies it as a medical disease, and it needs to be treated. And the only way to treat it is, A, to stop drinking long enough to figure out how to do that. And what needs to be changed.
Dan, let me hold you up. Is there anything, you just said it, stop drinking long enough to be treated. But is there anything, with the exception of you as the drinker, it could be anybody, you as the drinker making the decision to stop. There doesn't seem to be, like if a kid, with an extreme, if a kid is ADHD in school, well, they give them a little bit of Ritalin, and that calms that down. But you can't do that with drinking, can you?
No. It attacks you. It's in every fiber of my being, and every other alcoholic's being. It's mental, it's physical, it's emotional, it's spiritual, and all of those areas need to be addressed. And it's only by doing that, and when you say, what do you need to change? You need to change everything. And you really have to, number one, change the way you perceive yourself in relation to the rest of the world. Most alcoholics, what's the most self-centered creature in the face of the earth? It's probably a newborn baby.
Yeah.
When it pops out of the womb, it's sitting there, and it's, everybody and everything is there to serve it. Well, the alcoholic has a hard time getting off of that newborn baby status. And as a group, we are very emotionally immature. And as a group, we're extremely self-centered. And the self-centeredness is like the trunk of the tree. And then the sense of entitlement, the grandiosity, and all the other things that branch off from that. And the only way to combat that is to become less self-centered. And you say, well, how do you become less self-centered? And my answer to that is become more loving, because in a sum-zero world, the more loving I am gives me that much less time to be self-centered. And slowly, by degree, I change. Slowly, by degree, I move out of myself towards others and toward God. And that takes time. But when I do that, and when I continue to do that, I become comfortable in my own skin. I become someone that I can spend long periods of time with. One of the reasons I drank was because I hated myself. But everywhere I went, there I was, and if I drank enough, I could be an oblivion and not have to deal with me. So by becoming the person I've always wanted to be, or God meant me to be, I don't need to pick up a drink anymore. I don't feel the urge to pick up a drink anymore.
Dan, that I've seen over the years, and I've talked to so many people back and forth, on the air, off the air, whatever I've done in my lifetime and again, that have gone through the AA program, and the one constant that keeps coming back that I keep hearing was that you almost have to hit rock bottom before, and there's no place to go, there's no answers, there's nothing, before you'll take that step to start moving up again. And I've heard it so many times. Right. Imagine there was truth in that.
Well, without a doubt. But that bottom, it's different. The physical, emotional, financial circumstances surrounding the various bottoms for all the alcoholics is different. Where it's the same as what I said before, it's the exact moment when the perception of pain from the next drink outweighs the perception of pleasure. But awareness can get you to that point a lot sooner without suffering all the things I did. Without going through the jails and the hospitals and homelessness and living, in alleyways. You don't have to go that far. And in these days, In the early days of AA, I mean, just about everybody that came into the program had hit a rock bottom that was, you know, close to death. And now we're getting more and more people in that are still, you know, still married, still have their homes, still have cars, still have a job. But it's that feeling inside that, you know, the 12-step program of AA, there's actually a step zero, which is this stuff has got to stop.
Yeah.
And because there's so much more awareness today than there used to be, people come into the program earlier and seek help earlier than they used to.
Yeah, because alcoholism in and of itself, when one person in the family is an alcoholic, the entire family gets it. They may not all drink, but they get a reaction. They have to live with it. They've got to deal with it. And I would imagine that if you're coming out of it and you're going through AA, you got to have that support group, not only at AA, but that support group at home.
It helps. And I like to say that alcoholism is a family disease and everybody gets to play. And it's true. And it affects every member of the household, and they all acquire some degree of the disease, not necessarily by drinking, but that, you know, that's why you have groups like Al-Anon to help those people. But never let an alcoholic say that, you know, he can't get sober if he doesn't have his family or he doesn't have their support or any of those things, because it's not true. If he doesn't get sober first, he's going to lose all those things anyway. And the first priority, and it's a selfish program, the first priority has to be I'm not going to pick up a drink no matter what. And you know, I can't, if my family doesn't support me, that's fine. If my kids don't understand, that's fine. I got to do what I got to do, otherwise I'm no good to anyone. And so you got to have that singleness of purpose when you're initially getting sober. It takes time to find that ever elusive balance that we're looking for in family, work, and religion and everything else in our lives.
But that's really what it is. It is all about balance. And alcoholism, do you think that, you know, when did you start? What, 20, 25 years ago? How long have you been sober?
I've been sober 28 years now.
Okay, so you're talking 40-some-odd years then. You were an alcoholic for, what, 20 years?
Yeah, I drank alcoholically from 14 to 34.
Okay, all right. So when you really come down to it, alcoholism, you know, obviously it's no different than it was, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago than it is today. But what about the attitude towards it? Are we getting a little bit of a better attitude towards working with somebody who has the problem to help them move through it? Is it better today than it was?
Oh, yeah. There's no doubt about it. It's not where it should be, but it's much better than where it was. That's for sure. And it's just this, there's so much more awareness of it today, and there's so many people out there that are speaking on behalf of alcoholism and drug addiction, and it's, you know, the onslaught of the media is so much greater than when we had three TV stations and, you know, two radio stations back when I started drinking at age 14. And while alcoholics and what's kind of strange is that a recovering alcoholic can still be looked down upon more so than a guy who's still drinking. Mm. And you know, it's kind of crazy, but there's still that stigma attached to it. And it's not as much as it used to be, and there's a much greater understanding and a much greater acceptance of the disease concept. But there's still that stigma attached. And you know, a guy could be falling down drunk. He said, "Yeah, but at least he's not a, you know, recovering alcoholic."
Oh, sure. No, and again,
it's crazy, but that's the way it is.
Yeah, but there's also something else that comes along with it. And there's a depth that, if you can move through, there's a depth that you get and an understanding and an experience of life that most people will ever get. It's hell to go through, and not something that you would recommend to anybody. But at the other side of it, look at the legacy that this is going to give you. Look at the people, the lives you get to touch. And 100 years from now, if you work with somebody today and their kid and their kid's kid and their kid's kid can get something from what you've said or the book that you've written, then it makes it all worth it.
Oh, I mean, without a doubt. I mean, I shouldn't even be here today. I was close to death when I was 34. I was the oldest of four children. You know, my sister Darren died at 21 of a drug overdose. My brother Brian was 29 years old, cirrhosis of the liver. My brother Dennis, 42, liver failure. And I should have been one of them. And the only reason I'm here and they're not is because I'm lucky. And I hit bottom and recognized it, and they hit their bottoms as well and just didn't recognize it. And I can remember being with my brother Brian in the hospital. He's a guy that was, you know, 6'3", 240 pounds, and he's laying in bed there in Nershall Hospital, and he's you know, now 90 pounds, and he's bleeding from the nose and the eyes and ears, and you know, he looks at me and says, "Dan," he says, "get me a room in St. Vincent's," which was the local rehab. He says, "I want to get sober," and I could look in his eyes and I could see that he really did want to get sober.
Dan, we're starting to run out of time now. We're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Sure. Don't drink and go to meetings.com. Leave the apostrophe out of don't.
Okay, and we can get the book there?
And you can get the book there, or Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or bookstores everywhere.
Wonderful. Hey, Dan F., thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated you. And go out and get them. The world needs what you got.
I thank you very much, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are. I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Once upon a time, a girl with moonlight in her eyes put her hand in mine and said she loved me so.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
But that was once upon a time. Very long ago.
Hemant Gupta with us, the author of Joy from Deep Within, The Nature of Quantum Self. He spent over 20 years researching self-help ideals and the core of human emotions and applying the principles of quantum physics to better understand emotions and human spirituality. He holds a master's and a PhD degrees in chemical engineering with a specialization in polymer science from the University of Southern California, currently vice president in research and development at a major corporation. And again, he is the author of Road to Digital Divine, Computational Nature of Mind and Matter, and then again, Joy from Deep Within. Hemant, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, one of the things that we're dealing with, joy from deep within, the nature of the quantum self. How many people, Hemant, in life, basically, not so much a number, but really don't realize that there's a something else inside of them. There's that them that they never discover, and usually it's too late when they do. Well, it's never too late, but that self that they don't discover. How do you get to that point? How do you get somebody to recognize that there's more to them than they think there is?
It's very unfortunate that most of the people do not recognize that there is a core of our being that is full of joy, full of peace, and full of stillness. And until something really goes wrong in their life, and something propels them to search deep within that joy within us.
But I really believe emotions and behavior are there's something that we've learned to do over a time. You know, you have an experience. The experience creates an emotion. The emotion will create a behavior to protect you, or whatever the case may be. But the majority of it, if not all of it, Hemant, is learned. And I really believe if you can learn, you can unlearn, and you can relearn. And if you got a handle on pretty much how your brain is, your mind is, you can unlearn and relearn anything that you want, as long as you know you can do it.
That is true. That is exactly right. And then there are also certain type of emotions that you can discover that you're born with. And some of that has to do with the very fundamental programming that makes you who you really are. So when you are very little, let's say when you are born, a child, you intuitively respond to certain things. All that is also based on emotions. When you're hungry, you cry. And there are certain type of emotions that you display even when you haven't learned anything through your binary mind. So those are the emotions that are already present. They are the core of your being. And you're connected to the rest of the universe through that kind of programming. So there is a programming that resides within us, and that is also fundamentally related to the emotions.
Now, by the way, when we deal with emotions, our lives are driven by emotions, good emotions, bad emotions, and those emotions stimulate certain brain chemicals. And that's really where the key is. If we begin to understand how the inner workings of our mind and our body and our spirituality are all tied together, and what happens when certain things occur, because most of us live in the past, and that we are treating the world today as if it was circumstances out of the past, and it's not so. And too many people lose a lot of their life because they're just not living it. They're walking around and they're not alive.
Absolutely. Most of us live our lives that way. But we really don't have to. That is the key message here, is we have a programming that resides within us that we can discover. And it's almost like discovering ourselves. I've called that a quantum self. You can imagine that we are a big, large classical body, but we're made up of trillions and trillions of cells. And each of the cell, in turn, is made up of trillions of quantum particles or variables. So essentially, we are a very, very large quantum entity or colony of quantum particles. Almost each of the quantum particles are almost like information entity. So we are a large information entity which operates with a large number of programs which are either operating at the quantum level or a large classical level. So when we think and learn, and a lot of the binary type of process that we relate ourselves to, a lot of that has to do with with us learning as a large classical entity. Now, at the core of our being, there are programs that we can also understand and learn, and that has to do with covering ourselves. In that case, you're essentially looking at what is going on inside of me. So you're paying more attention to the inside of you than the outside that you have done the learning from or learning off. So in other words, that you are constantly asking the question, who I am, what is the core nature of my being, how am I connected to the universe, and what is this really universe all about? Now, that whole discovery takes you in a whole new path of finding out who you really are. And that's something that I've spent a lot of time with, and I've called it quantum self. The nature of the quantum self, that's where the joy resides. And this really, the joy is free. It's available to all of us. It's like a big gift that has been attached to us, and a lot of us just forget to open it. And if we learn how to open it, then we have the joy for the rest of our lives.
Now, the word joy is a very interesting word because there's so many people who say joy, love, and so on and so forth, and there are many people out there that say, yeah, sure, here we go again, because they don't realize that joy is not just walking 2 feet off the ground and living in a world that really doesn't exist. Joy is the ability to go to sleep at night and get a full night's sleep. Get up in the morning and smile, enjoy the people that you're with. It doesn't have to be this massive thing. It could be just the basic detail of life. And that puts it into something that's manageable and is not beyond your reach. You talk about joy to somebody who's going through a lot of miseries, they're not going to relate to you. And at the same time, joy doesn't have to be something that is way beyond their ability to grasp. And everybody can have it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Joy is enjoying every little moment of your existence, of your life, every small little thing, drinking coffee, just going out outside, having a little walk, and just enjoying absolutely all aspects of our being, looking outside at the sunset or morning sun, and just absolutely immerse yourself in the beauty of anything out there. And not only that, just really simple stuff, just your own room, your own surroundings, the work that you do, just absolutely enjoy that. And I've called that as an emotional fullness. It's the emotional fullness or the completeness is really the core of our being. Its fundamental nature is emptiness or completeness. And that is quantum, by definition, quantum in nature. So that's where that we, if we can learn how to put our attention to that full entity or the fullness or the emptiness, then we can learn the meaning of what is it emotional fullness truly means.
Is there a definition of it when you say emotional trueness? The base of that, wouldn't that come from allowing yourself to be yourself, knowing that it's okay to be you? We run through life constantly, day in, day out, trying to keep up with everybody else. And if we're not doing what they're doing, then we're not good enough, and so on and so forth. So isn't a lot of that having to give yourself permission to be yourself, and that it's okay to be yourself? And that in and of itself can cause a tremendous amount of joy if somebody will just slow down, take a breath, and realize it's okay.
Absolutely. This is the core of your being. Be who you really are. And that is, to some extent, we may say that, well, you know, I could choose to be selfish, and I could choose to be, you know, centered towards my own happiness. But what I would suggest is that go deeper inside. As you go really deeper inside, you will understand the meaning of who you really are. And you would find that you are more than a person who may be centered around your own happiness or selfish pursuits. So you will. It's absolutely true that you need to be who you really are, but you have to also keep on digging deep inside to find that quantum self or the self that really exists for others. Ultimately, it does exist for your for yourself as well, but it is also as much for others as it is for yourself.
Oh, no question about it, and I think that there's that old adage about being on a plane and there's some problems on the plane. You got a baby in your lap and the oxygen drops. Do you put it on the baby or do you put it on yourself? You put it on you, then you can protect the baby. You can put it on the baby, then you're in major trouble. So a lot of giving to other people, is making sure that you're the best self to yourself. Because if I don't love me, I can't love you. If I don't like me, I can't like you. So it really starts with, and it's not being selfish. It's building that whoever you are inside, because that's the only thing that you can give away.
Absolutely. This is the core programming that holds you. It's like this, that you have a lot of, like an onion. You peel away your layers one after another. And ultimately, there will be a point where you can't peel anymore. You are what you are. And you have to confront with that. And that fundamental belief of who you are, what is that self, that just will fill you with complete emotional fullness and joy. And you don't really have to do anything. It will just come out. And once you face that reality, once you exist in that type of reality, you will find that the joy would not stop coming. Anything that you do, anything that you're involved in, it will be your companion. It will keep on coming out in your existence, and the whole nature will conspire for you to be successful in that particular task. Whatever that task you do, if you are in that reality, it's an amazing type of reality.
Sure, no question about it. Iman, we're just about running out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at and buy the book?
Oh, yes. It's at www.joyfromdeepwithin.com.
Wonderful. Iman Gupta, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Michael. Appreciate it.
Take care. Okay, good night.
Good night.
They say in this business, that's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling. Parting out as friends.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is
a
wrap.
Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new.